all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type helicopter pilot, Vietnam 1969. We want to welcome you to our special program today because we're going to be talking about helicopters, right? And the reason that I decided to do this program is twofold. Number one is that there's an event coming up on April 18th to honor all military helicopter pilots and crewmen that served in Vietnam. There's a monument that's going to be placed in Arlington National Cemetery on April 18th, and we're going to be talking about that today. We're also going to be talking about kind of the history of the helicopter. We've got a number of guests lined up. They're all pilots, but we want you to call in also, especially if you're a crewman. Set up any crewmen, and I think that's been an important issue that we need to address today, because we couldn't have stayed in the air without our crews, that's for sure, and many of us wouldn't have survived without our crews, that's for darn sure. I want to play a little segment for you, it's a little clip from a good friend of ours here at Veterans Radio and a good friend of all veterans everywhere, and that's Joe Galloway. And Joe Galloway, as many of you who are listening today know, that he was one of the authors of We Were Soldiers Once and Young. And he talks about, in this little segment, it runs about 2 minutes, he talks about what a helicopter means to the people on the ground. And so we're going to play that, and then we'll be right back with my first guest, and that's going to be Bob Helsebein, and he's the chairman of the group that has planned this whole monument thing at Arlington. So stay tuned for that. We've got a whole bunch of other people. If you want to call us, do that. It's 734-822-1600. But first, let's listen to what Joe Galloway has to say.
Here today who doesn't thrill to the sound of those blades. That familiar wop 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 is the soundtrack of our war, the lullaby of our younger days. To someone who spent his time in Nam with the grunts, I've got to tell you that noise was always a great comfort. It meant someone was coming to help. Someone was coming to get our wounded. Someone was coming to bring us water and ammo. Someone was coming to take our dead brothers home. And eventually, someone was coming to give us a ride out of hell. Even today, when I hear it, I stop, catch my breath, and think back to those days. I love you guys as only an infantryman can. No matter how bad things were, if we called, you came. Down through the green tracers and other visible signs of a real bad day, off to a real bad start. To us, you seemed beyond brave and fearless, that you would come to us in the middle of battle, in those flimsy, thin-skinned crates, and in the storm of fire, you would sit up there behind that thin plexiglass, seeming so patient and so calm and so vulnerable, waiting for the offloading and the onloading. We thought you were God's own lunatics, and we loved you. Still do. We're the fortunate ones. We survived when so many better men gave up their precious lives for us. We owe them a sacred debt to live each day to its fullest. What they're saying when you listen hard enough is this: we're at peace, and so should you be. And so should you be.
And that was Joe Galloway with his comments about helicopter pilots are God's own lunatics. And that actually was from the documentary In the Shadow of the Blade. It's something that many of you would like to watch, which is the story of a journey of a Vietnam-era helicopter from the West Coast to Washington. But joining me right now on the line is a retired Army Air Force, or retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Bob Hasselbein. Flew AH-1 Cobra gunships in Vietnam. Obviously, he was in the Army at the time and went into the Air Force and continued flying. He's also kind of the spearhead of the memorial that is going to be coming up here at Arlington Cemetery on the 18th. So, Bob, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, Dale, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It is my pleasure. When I found out about this monument, I just thought, wow, this is, it's about time, I guess, that that somebody acknowledges, you know, what pilots went through. And I want to make sure that, unfortunately, all the pilots that are going to be on today's program are all Army at one time or another. And I didn't get any Navy or Marine, but all of us that flew in those flimsy machines, as Joe said, are so grateful for the work that you've done to put this monument together.
Well, thank you, Dale. It was a team effort. It could never have been done without the help of a lot of people, both veterans and non-veterans, people who saw the value of honoring the almost 5,000 helicopter pilots and crew members who gave their life for the nation. If you include the Americans who were passengers on board those flights that were shot down or crashed for other reasons, the number is over 6,000, over 10%. Of all who were killed in the war died on a helicopter.
Wow. I never thought of it that way until I saw those statistics. And again, it just kind of reminds me of how lucky and fortunate that I was. Unlike so many of our other comrades in arms. So, Bob, tell me a little bit about how you got involved in this. And I know that there's a number of organizations that are behind this monument.
In 2015, the VHPA, Vietnam Helicopter Pilot Association, which we call the VHPA, was planning a reunion, an annual reunion in the Washington, D.C. area. And we thought it would be a nice thing to perhaps have a treat dedicated within Arlington National Cemetery to honor those who died. And in April of 2014, we were at a meeting with officials, and they said, have you thought about putting a monument anywhere? Because Arlington National Cemetery in particular has a cluster of casualties. Some 20% of all Vietnam casualties who were buried in Arlington during the war were helicopter pilots and crew members. Medal of Honor recipients are buried there who were helicopter pilots and crew members. And, of course, all the MIA crews are also returned from Southeast Asia. Some decades later, they all come to Arlington. This is the place to do this. Mm-hmm. So that started us on our adventure. We thought if we started this in 2014, we'd be dedicating a monument in August of 2016, and we discovered the path was not that easy, but we persevered. It took many efforts. It was an uphill struggle, but through the help of so many people, different veterans groups got on board. We were able to get legislators to introduce legislation, and I think the Army, when they recognized the outpouring of enthusiasm and desire to see this monument be placed there, they acquiesced. We met. We came to an agreement on the appropriate size of a monument in a great location, and we're dedicating that on April 18th.
All right. And that's going to be, what time is that going to be for those of people that are listening out in the Washington area?
It's going to be 4 p.m., but we're anticipating somewhere possibly 5,000 or more people. We're recommending everyone try to get there probably at 2 in the afternoon to the Welcome Center if they can, because there is some screening that goes on, and we will have transportation to help people up the hill from the Welcome Center to the amphitheater itself until it starts at 4.
Okay. And where can they go to find out more information?
VHPA.org has it. There's also a Facebook page for the Vietnam Helicopter Pilot and Crew Member Monument, and just Google it, and you'll certainly find information.
Okay, that's what I'm looking at. Okay, so we've got that done, which is awesome, I think. It's so exciting. So many people now can go to Arlington and see that monument. So tell us what you did in Vietnam. Where were you, and what was your job during your tour?
I was the classic Vietnam helicopter pilot, high school to flight school. Went in right out of high school into the Army, basic training, then to beautiful Fort Walters, then Fort Rucker. checked out as a Cobra gunship pilot. Then I got to Vietnam January 2nd of 1972, where I was told at the age of 19, oh, you'll only be here 6 months because the war is ending. And they were wrong. It was a full-year tour. But for me, it was an experience that is framed just like probably for every Vietnam veteran the rest of their life. It's the experiences I saw of great leaders, brave people, astonishing events, some tragedies. It really defined and helped me to grow up. And by the age of 20, I felt that I was ready to do just about anything in the world that needed to get done because of not just the confidence of what we did as helicopter pilots, rescuing people and protecting people, but seeing great people operate those machines as great leaders. Some you'll talk to today, like Mike Sloniker and Hugh Mills. Hugh Mills was a legend to me when I flew with him in Vietnam. He remains one today. And Mike Sloniker has done a great job of capturing the history of the helicopters and the helicopter operators in what is known as the helicopter war.
Well, it certainly was a helicopter war, and I'm much like you, went and, you know, did the Wally Warrant trip into, you know, becoming a pilot right out of a couple of years of college, as they said, and I got to go to Fort Polk, Louisiana, so I got to go to Tigerland, and like many of us did, and I was kind of concerned right there because I said I'm supposed to go to flight school, not become a combat infantryman for Vietnam, but they said everybody gets to go through Tigerland. At least that's the way they talk down there. And it was an exciting time, that's for sure, and I think all of us came out, at least the vast majority, I think, of us came out that nothing could stop us now, and that if we were able to survive that we could probably do pretty much anything in our lives. And as we look back on it, I think then we say, what was I thinking?
Yeah, well, I think so. But one thing that I will point out, we sent 12,000 helicopters. The United States deployed 12,000 helicopters approximately to Vietnam, and some 5,500 were fully and completely destroyed. That meant not shot down, recovered, and repaired and flown again, fully and completely destroyed. And the way we flew there, I don't believe has been matched since as far as the risks that were taken to save people on the ground, whether they were soldiers or doing medical evacuations under terrible conditions or perhaps rescuing a downed crew. Years later, I flew fighters in the Air Force, both A-10 Warthogs and F-16 Vipers. And when I told guys how we operated in Vietnam, they didn't believe me, I think, because they would Air Force and how they fly helicopters today, they would never take the risks and the casualties that we routinely did in that war.
I think that's true, and it's a good segue. Thank you, Bob, for the segue, because joining us on the line right now is one of those medevac pilots, and I believe he's on the line right. That's Art Jacobs. And Art, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. Thank you, Bob.
So the standard question, when were you there and what did you do?
I was there in 1968. During the Tet Offensive and flew medevac. And in 1971, I flew Cobras. So I got to see the helicopter war from two different perspectives altogether.
I would certainly say that. How did you end up flying medevacs?
Well, my dad was in the Army Air Corps in World War II, and my mother's brother was a combat medic in the infantry in World War II, and I was just always in awe of the stories they told. So it was kind of a perfect storm. When I was in flight school, they said they were looking for volunteers to fly air rescue, and I thought, wow, that sounds like it would be not just interesting, but, you know, constructive. And I went to Fort Sam Houston for 4 weeks of medical and air rescue training before getting to Vietnam.
Okay, and were you an officer when you did this, or did you go through the warrant officer plan also?
I went through the warrant officer program, but I had been an enlisted man for 2 years. I'd spent a year with an artillery battery in Korea before flight school. And then between tours, I was with the 10th Special Forces Group as their aviation officer and took a direct commission to first lieutenant. And by the time I went back to Vietnam, I was a captain.
Okay. All right. Can you tell our audience? I know our audiences are always amazed at just the term medevac pilot. Everybody, you know, can't imagine the jobs that you did and how many people are alive because of the work that you did. But I don't think that they understand that most medevacs were unarmed aircraft. Is that correct?
They were. They belonged to the 44th Medical Brigade, the different dust-off mm-hmm. detachments. But I was with the 1st CAV.
Okay.
And the 1st CAV had their own organic medevac platoon in the 15th Medical Battalion. And we carried M60s, not just for defense, but that meant we had a crew chief and a door gunner on the left and right side for better visibility.
Mm-hmm. Did you? Were one of those two crewmen medical or medics, or did you also carry a medic with you?
We also carried a medic.
Okay, and I'm sure if you could tell our audience a little bit about, you know, a couple of your rescue attempts and successful rescues, of course. Did you ever have to use penetrators, or did you, you know, hoist them up and so forth?
When we were in the northern part of Vietnam in I Corps, we had many missions in the mountains between the Laotian border and the coast. So we probably used the jungle penetrator on an average of once every other day, and there were some missions or some days where we'd use it on three or four missions, lowering that cable into the jungle since mm-hmm. there was no place to land.
I've always admired medevac pilots, and there's a couple of them that live in this area, and their stories are just hair-raising. Because, as Bob pointed out, and I think all of us that flew helicopters in Vietnam, that if there was somebody on the ground and we could get to the ground, we would go and get him.
Dale, if I can just interrupt, Art is very shy about his valor, but one story in particular. He was called out to do a medevac to rescue wounded people in a unit under fire. Art came in, and of course he had to do a high hover to lower that penetrator to get guys mm-hmm. out. And while that was happening, his aircraft was so badly riddled by bullets that he had to call off the medevac and make an emergency landing with his damaged bird. He then took a second aircraft back to the same place, same unit under fire, in, as I understand, not real great weather. As he was hovering, trying to get the jungle penetrator down again, even though there's fire support around them trying to suppress the enemy, his Huey was not only shot up, but his co-pilot was wounded. And Art, I'm not sure that you were wounded on that or not, but that aircraft was too badly damaged to continue the mission. So Art then went back to his unit where they said, Art, we're out of medical helicopters. We have one that's in maintenance, but it's not been certified as safe to fly. And Art said, I'll take it. They need me. So he had to sign a waiver saying he was taking a potentially mechanically unsound aircraft out there. And that third time around, Art was successful in rescuing people, and he was awarded a medal for that. But what I find astonishing about fine heroes like Art is he doesn't talk about the story. Others have to know about the story and tell it behind his back.
Well, I appreciate that, Bob. I know I've run into quite a few veterans like that.
And I'm glad we can tell that story about Art today.
Well, actually, Bob, you got one detail incorrect. It was on the second mission that we actually successfully got one guy up. And just as he got to the skids, we took all that fire and the emergency lights were coming on. But it was on the third mission that I was wounded, and we never made it back to the base. The engine quit because of the enemy fire, and we went down into the jungle and had to wait for our own rescue. So I got to see medevac from more than one angle.
It was worse than I remember telling it. Thanks, Art.
It's. I don't think our audience could ever understand the idea of being on the ground with your broken helicopter and waiting for another one to come and get you. I'm going to ask either one of you, Bob, could you kind of describe for our audience the armament that they had on a Huey? We're talking here mostly about UH-1s right now.
Art could probably talk better than I can, since I mainly flew covers. But the pilots sit in armored seats, which can stop a 30 caliber bullet, something like an M16 or something, a rifle round fired from an AK-47. You also had chest armor, which is ceramic plates that were wrapped in a canvas thing that was strapped around your torso. and that would also stop a bullet of that magnitude, but leave tremendous bruises. Unfortunately, if it was a larger caliber round, like a 12.7, an anti-aircraft machine gun round, it would penetrate all of that armor. The crew chiefs had that chest armor as well. And the only other armor protection on the helicopter was a little piece of ceramic armor that would try to protect a what's called a fuel control for the jet turbine engine,
right,
which was vital to its operation. And to my knowledge, that's all the armor they had during the Vietnam War.
Right. Yeah, we all wore the armor plate, better known as a chicken plate.
Correct.
That's because we tried to hide behind it as much as we could. Sometimes the crewmen would sit on a chicken plate in addition to the one that they wore, because you got to remember the bullets come up through the floor quite often, and there wasn't any protection for that. And you would, if you had a pistol, you would put that between your legs as, quote, your protection there. But that was about it. And a ballistic helmet, theoretically. And, yeah, that was it. I can't imagine.
Today's what is astonishing about that war is you think about aircraft flying between 70 and 90 miles per hour. I'm putting in automobile terms for your audience who listens. Mm-hmm. And so many bullets were fired compared to those who hit. It's just astonishing that more aircraft were not brought down. You'd see all these tracers flying around you, and the majority of them would miss, which was something we're all grateful for, but it's still rather unnerving at the moment.
Yeah, I can't imagine how they missed that much. I mean, it looked like a fire hose coming up at you, but luckily in most cases it did miss. Well, Art, so did you stay in the service after that?
No, after my second tour, I got out and went back to school. I thought I might take a job in the airline, so I went to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. There were a lot of pilots getting out of the service at the time, so the airlines weren't hiring, so I went on and got my MBA, my master's degree at University of Florida, and I've been in business ever since.
Well, Art, I want to thank you very, very much for being on Veterans Radio today, and thank you, and an honest thank you for your service, and I'm sure that there are many, many people, many, many families also today that would love to thank you for what you did in bringing their soldiers home. Thank you.
Well, I would like to point out my crew members. As you and Bob have both said, without them, we wouldn't have been able to accomplish the mission, especially the medics. Mm-hmm. In the back, under fire. There were, on those three aircraft that day, there were 10 of us, in total on the three different flights, and five of us were wounded. But, you know, for the guys on the ground, the kids who were hoping someone would come, we always went. And, I still tell people this today, flying that mission, medevac, was the finest thing I've ever done.
You know, and it brings tears to our eyes every time we think about it. I think that that's the emotional toll that some of those missions that we did are with us forever. And I want to thank you for what you did. Thank you, Art, very much.
Well, thank you, Dale. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much for being on the program. So, Bob, we've got about 3 minutes till the bottom of the hour, and we'll see who calls in next. For those of you out there that are listening, like to get in on the conversation, the number is 734-822-1600, and we'd love to get you on the air if we can. So you mentioned before that there were what did you say, about 12,000 helicopters in Vietnam?
Just under 12,000, correct.
Right.
All branches of service.
Right. I'm looking at the notes, and I got to give Gary Roush credit for this. Gary Roush is with the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots of America and all the other organizations out there, and he's put together a spreadsheet that's got helicopters by designation, how many were destroyed, unfortunately, how many people got killed, wounded, and so on and so forth. Let's talk about in 2 minutes, 3 minutes, I think we've got. 2 minutes. How did the helicopters get involved with the Army? Let's look at it from a historical perspective real quick. We got 2 minutes.
Okay, sure. In my 2 minutes that I can talk about this, the first helicopters were actually used in World War II. In Burma, they were used to medevac soldiers. The first medevacs came in World War II. Korea saw the first use of helicopters for more significant medevac. Everyone's probably seen MASH on TV at least once. They were also used for observation. The Marine Corps used them for resupply and trying to rescue pilots who had crashed in enemy terrain or in the water. The French were the first to use air mobility in the Algerian rebellion. They had 600 helicopters in Algiers, and very few people know that.
Okay.
But the real father of helicopter aviation in Vietnam was a Marine general by the name of Krulak, who created a concept called air mobility, where whole units would be moved by helicopter. And astonishingly enough, it was the Army who embraced Marine General Krulak's concept that led to the expanded use of helicopters in Vietnam, and they literally led the concept of helicopters being able to move whole divisions, do everything, lift artillery, provide their own helicopter artillery support, observation, resupply, combat assault, and medevac. And that led to the zenith of two Army divisions being air mobile. The Marines, by 69, were kind of grabbing on the air mobile concept, but they still use them more of a support role than the Army did.
Right, and I recently talked to someone in the Air Force that also was running helicopters into Laos with a special operations or special observation.
They did indeed, and banned me to it. The Air Force had Huey helicopters that were being used with special ops people to do that kind of thing, sneaking into Laos and Cambodia. But the Air Force is generally known for taking large helicopters to rescue down jet pilots. And I always tell people that the Air Force would send up big lumbering CH-43s and H-3s before that, and they would fly up there at 100 knots or 110 knots to rescue the jet pilots who were shot down by the very guns that were going to shoot at those helicopters.
Right. Yeah, well, we, you know, that's why we're called God's own lunatics. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. We've talked about cobras. We've talked about medevac. When we come back, we're going to talk about loaches. So you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after the news.
I am an American fighting man. An Army aviator, serving with the forces that make our country free. I will never forget my duty, my men, my honor. I will trust in my God, my country, and my ship.
Winged soldiers, are we?
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and that was a recording that I found by the Warrant Officer Candidate Choir, and it's called Winged Soldiers. So I thought it was kind of interesting. On the line with me right now is, where did he go? He's right here, Bob Hesselbein. And Bob is responsible, or one of the many responsible, for arranging for a monument to be approved and be placed in Arlington Cemetery on April 18th, and it's to honor helicopter pilots and their crewmen. And so we've talked with Bob about the different types of helicopters that are out there, and as we mentioned, Bob, that most of the ones that the Army had, at least, were some sort of Huey model. I mean, we bump up to the Chinooks and to the Sky Cranes and so forth, and then we kind of come down and get smaller and smaller as we go. Right?
Yes, that seemed to be the case.
It did seem to be the case, because I had a very good friend of mine, Ray Schrader, who was a warrant officer also, did scout work for an artillery unit up in 2 Corps. And he started off flying loaches, but I think he broke them all. And then he ended up flying an OH-23s. Now, for our audience out there, the OH-23 is about the same vintage as the helicopters that you saw on MASH. Those were OH-13s, I believe. And then they also had, we ended up using these as trainers, didn't we?
Yes, as a matter of fact, by the time you were there and by the time I was there, we'd gotten rid of all the reciprocating engines and everything was a jet turbine.
Oh, and so what did you go through flight school with?
I did OH-23s.
Okay, they're beautiful. They were interesting. And then the other people flew the Hughes, TH-55?
Yes.
Better known as the Mattel Messerschmitt.
I was going to say that exact word, yes.
See, people think I make up these things. I don't. Everybody doesn't understand. But those types of helicopters were in Vietnam, and right now we're bringing on another guest to talk about the helicopters in Vietnam, and his name is Hugh Mills, and Hugh Mills flew Loaches, and Loaches were used for low-level reconnaissance a lot of the time, and many parts of the time, or many times, they were used as hunter, what we used to call hunter-killer teams, where they would fly low and slow over the trees, and there would be a cobra, like Bob's, up on top, waiting for them to uncover things, and they always seem to do that probably on a daily basis. So I want to welcome Hugh Mills to Veterans Radio. Hugh, welcome.
Thanks, Dale, and Bob, good to talk to you, brother.
It's good to hear you again.
So, Hugh, tell me about when were you there, and what was your job?
Well, I was there. I did three tours as a helicopter pilot, 69 as a scout pilot in Dark Horse, the 4th Cavalry, 71 with Charlie Horse, 3rd of the 5th Cav, flying Cobras up in I Corps. And then I extended at the end of that tour and went back to Dark Horse again to command the Aero Scout Platoon in the Delta, where I had the great pleasure of having Bob Hesselbein as one of the guys that protected. I would also say very quickly, Art Jacobs and I are fraternity brothers in Sigma Chi, and Mike Sloniker, who's up later, is also an old friend.
My goodness. So when you knew Art, was this before you went in, or did you go through the warrant officer program as well, or did you come as an officer?
No, I enlisted as an 11 Bush. I was selected for officer candidate school, okay. Went to OCS at Fort Knox in 68, and while I was there, just on a lark, I took the flight school test, and part of that process was you had to go fly in an Army aircraft before they would finalize your application, and I did that at Fort Knox, and interestingly, the aircraft I did it in was an 086, which was brand new in 1968.
Right.
I flew 23s and 13s in primary flight, and then I flew A and B model Hueys in secondary flight at Rucker. Mm-hmm. Flew D models and H models for about a month when I got to Vietnam in 69, but really wanted to fly scouts. That's where I wanted to go. And unfortunately, in that particular unit, folks became casualties to commit to create, if you will, vacancies. And that's how I got the scout platoon when my predecessor was injured.
Okay. And you were in 3 Corps.
I was in 3 Corps based out of Phu Loi. We flew 1st Infantry Division. Primarily also worked a great deal with the 11th Armored Cav Regiment, 25th Division, and elements of 2 Corps, or
right,
3 Corps, rather.
Right, up in Black Horse, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Well, I that's the same area I was in, because Hugh has written a really fascinating book called Low-Level Hell, and I just got a chance to read parts of it over the last couple of days, and you were in a lot of areas I was, because we worked out of Long Bin and mostly out of Quan Loi is where we staged. We did those over the fence things that I can't.
Oh sure, yeah.
That
yeah.
I can't talk about.
We were in Quan Loi routinely.
And describe the Loach to our audience, if you could, please.
The most folks that have not been in the military but have seen Magnum PI have seen the helicopter used on that show. That is a Hughes 500. The 086 is the military version of the Hughes 500. The only real difference is that Army aircraft are flown from the right seat rather than the left seat. It was a small airplane, not much bigger than a Volkswagen. Jet turbine engine, although it only ran about 272 shaft horsepower, the weight to power ratio was so great that it was really a very, very nimble aircraft, although not very heavily armored. Pilot seat was armor plated. The crew chief behind me, the gunner, had to bring his own armor with him. The chicken plates front and back, but the pilot did have an armored seat. And as Bob alluded to earlier, the fuel control on the Loach also had an armor bucket, but mm-hmm. We mounted a minigun, a 7.62 Gatling gun on the left-hand side, a door gunner in the back with a M60, and then a single pilot up front. So, and that's the way we operated as part of what you called earlier the hunter-killer team, hunter element.
Right. So there was only one pilot. That was it.
Some units flew with an observer up front and a gunner in the back, and they left the minigun at home. Our unit preferred the firepower of the minigun because we were a combat tracker unit, an air cavalry unit, and our job was to find the enemy force. And so when you do that, it's kind of a good deal to have that minigun with you.
I would think so. Could you describe a typical mission to our audience for us, please?
Typical mission would be off at first light from Fuloy to wherever we were going to work. We worked an area called the Iron Triangle almost routinely. Mm-hmm. The Cobra would give us a mark on the ground to go down to. The front seat Cobra was watching me and writing things on the bubble, what I saw and what I said. And the guy in the back was watching me and ready to roll in and throw rockets where I was if I got into trouble. We flew 4 to 6 feet above the highest obstacle, which was generally the ground or the treetops. And most of our engagements were eyeball to eyeball. Mm-hmm. We could see, we could smell enemy troops. A lot of folks jump back when I say that, but yeah, we could smell large concentrations of enemy troops.
You could. We went out on quote a people sniffer mission one time, and I won't describe what we were looking. They came up with this contraption that measured the amount of ammonia in the air.
Yeah. Well, we actually the contraption we used was our nose.
Much more effective.
and it was extremely exciting. It was invigorating. It was dangerous. A lot of casualties in the scouts, but we were very young and we were very focused on what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And very few, if any, of my guys were married. One that I can think of, and he was unfortunately killed.
Well, I think, and Bob, you can jump in on this too. I think we all felt that we had this mission, and our mission, or at least in my mind, was wherever an American ran into trouble, we would get them out. The same thing with the Vietnamese, same thing with the Koreans, whatever it was, if they were our allies and they ran into a problem, we would do whatever we could to get them out safely.
Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
And if I can leap in here, Dale,
go ahead.
The audience might want to know, when we use the word LOACH, that's sort of an acronym for Light Observation Helicopter,
right.
LOH turned into LOACH. And, you know, when we talk about these hunter-killer missions, one of the greatest challenges of the Vietnam War was finding the enemy in the terrain. They were experts at camouflage and hiding, and in 80% of the engagements, the enemy would initiate the battle, but generally through ambush, mm-hmm. and what the air cavalry units provided was the ability to go out in front of the troops and find the enemy. And incidentally, he wasn't saying this, but it's not like these enemies were standing there just waiting to be found. Often they were carefully camouflaged, and Hugh might have to pass over the place two or three times. And Hugh, if you could, just describe what it was like trying to find one or two or three people down the Mekong Delta.
Actually, the easiest way to find these guys was to follow their footprints. We were at such an altitude and airspeed that we could follow footprints. I have actually followed burning cigarette butts directly to a group of people. But footprints made early in the morning and fresh, pretty easy to follow in the grass, certainly easy to follow in sand and mud. And we made our reputation as combat trackers. Visual acuity and instinct, in my opinion, were the two greatest attributes a scout pilot could have. I grew up in Arkansas. I was a hunter. Most of the guys that were good scouts were good old country boys. So the ability to find them, fix them, and then to bring greater firepower to bear like the Cobra was what our daily mission was.
Well, you know, folks, you're listening to Veterans Radio. We are talking with Bob Hesselbein, who was a Cobra pilot initially in Vietnam. Right now we're talking with Hugh Mills, who was a LOACH pilot, a light observation helicopter pilot in Vietnam. If you want to give us a call, please do. It's 734-822-1600. Or hopefully maybe you're just fascinated by these stories. I didn't get a chance to ask Art what, you know, what medals he had received. I'm reading Hugh's bio here on from the book. Again, check this out. It is an exciting book, Low Level Hell. It says that, like most of pilots and most people of veterans, they don't talk much about the awards that they've gotten. But this guy got four Distinguished Flying Crosses, folks. Four of them. That's a lot. 72 Air Medals, six with V for Valor, three Army Commendations, all with V device for Valor. That's unheard of. We just had a gentleman here in our local area, and maybe some of you have met him, I don't know, Charlie Kettles, or Chuck Kettles, just received his Medal of Honor, and he was a pilot in Vietnam in 1967. He was a pilot, I think, in Korea. And, you know, just a, never talked about, you know, what he accomplished. And it, his accomplishment was much like General Brady's was, you know, kept going back into the LZ again and again and again, and broke a number of helicopters. In fact, had to borrow helicopters from another unit. And as a joke, the Department of the Army sent him a bill for $8 million for 22 helicopters that had been busted. But so humble. I mean, and it's great to talk with you people and, you know, and how humble you are. And I want our audience to know that the vast majority of Vietnam veterans are just like the ones that are on the program today, folks. They're very humble men who have gone on and been successful in their lives and are still probably taking care of veterans, I'll bet you.
Well, one thing I'd like to add to that, Dale, is since we have Hugh on the radio right now, is I had the opportunity many times to orbit overhead while Hugh was down in the weeds digging the enemy out of wherever they were hiding. And he would get into engagements, and we'd often be saying, get out of there so we could come in with our firepower, because Hugh would get so involved in what he was doing, he wanted to deal with them himself. And honestly, many of us really wonder how he survived. He did. He led a charmed life. He was a brave American hero. But honestly, sitting overhead, we used to just grit our teeth hoping that he would not get blasted out of the sky, because he was, I don't want to say wild man because that means out of control, but he was an extremely considered aggressive scout pilot, and that book describes what he did very well, Low Level Hell.
Yeah, I think, you know, there were so many pilots that were in Vietnam that we can, you know, that we all can remember, and, you know, maybe we did that. I think the one thing that the vast majority of us did is that we acted professionally, and, you know, we took risks when we thought they were necessary. We didn't take unnecessary risks if, in most cases, but we just, you know, you have this sixth sense, I think, that, you know, that you can do this or you can't do that. I mean, unfortunately, the ground is probably filled with a lot of those helicopters from people who thought they could take a risk and it didn't work. But it sounds like you did that. We've got about 10 minutes to go. Hugh, I want you to stay on the line. I think we're going to be able to do this.
Okay.
And I've got one more gentleman I want to bring on, and that's Mike Slaniker. And Mike was a Huey pilot in Vietnam. So, Mike, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, I've been listening, and I just really think this is a fantastic thing you're doing today. Let me give you some quick background. I was an ROTC graduate from Oklahoma State, and I was 120 days after getting commissioned, I was in country as a forward observer in the 101st.
Wow.
So my first tour was on the ground, and then came back to the States and was dissatisfied with being a gunner instructor at Fort Sill, and went to flight training as a captain. And It all was incredible from that day on, and I got to go to the Easter Offensive of 72 with A Company 229. And what I want to tell this audience about the slick pilots is, you know, we carried the troops in and out. We did the resupply. When medevac was full and they needed to get more people out, we would have them on board. We didn't have any medics.
Mm-hmm.
Just a jack of all trades. And I saw some incredible teenage pilots that just were absolutely fearless. And it reminds me of the John Wayne saying, courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway.
Absolutely. So yeah, I think we were all frightened to death.
The next thing I wanted to do in this short time we've got left is a book that says that. And it's mm-hmm. called Legend by Eric Blehm, B-L-E-H-M. This is a sister unit to you. It's the 240th out of 240th, the Greyhounds.
Oh, okay.
This book is about the time that Benavides did the things he did for the Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And the 240th went, it was his support aircraft. This is a special operations mission in Cambodia, out of Quang Loi.
Right.
And this book is the only book I've read ever that has a helicopter crew in it their helicopter wouldn't work anymore at Quang Loi. They didn't have a crew chief and a gunner left. Four warrant officers flew this aircraft in there to get these special operators out. This is a book of incredible bravery, and it's the 240th Greyhounds.
I am familiar with them.
I'm seeing stuff in Oklahoma that is incredible. We have a gentleman out in a little town called O'Keen. His name is Bob Ford.
Yep.
And he has got he put a Huey on a stick in Shawnee, Oklahoma. So the people mm-hmm. are aware of that. And then inside the Oklahoma History Center crossing the Capitol, he hung one from the ceiling. It's the 282nd Black Hats.
Mm-hmm.
And he has done so much for the memory of the helicopter in the state of Oklahoma. It's incredible. We have 78 members in the Oklahoma chapter of the BHVA. And the pride they had and still have in doing that is incredible. And it's constant here where people thank us for our service.
Mm-hmm. I think that's going on all over the country. Suddenly we are all, you know, we all survived, and everybody's finally acknowledging that we did survive. And, you know, that without getting too political, you know, we didn't lose the war. The war was over. You know, we went home before the war was over. And if it hadn't been for the government deciding to withhold their funds, I think we could have persevered. But the idea of reaction right now to people, to Vietnam veterans, is so positive. It really feels good. And I think many of us are looking back on our time and our service in Vietnam with a little bit more pride than maybe we did, 30 years ago or so.
You know,
you want to jump in on that?
I want to tell you, I spent 25 years in Northern Virginia, and this thing that Bob Hasselbein pulled off is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
To get that much support to do this because of the bureaucracy of how they want things done at Arlington National Cemetery. This is an incredible event that he's pulled off and got in there, and, you know, it takes a team effort to do it, but this is just the top of the best thing I've ever seen, because from 87 to 2011, I went to 62 funerals in that place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of the things you have to do to make things happen in there. And this is just absolutely incredible.
Well, I think we're all very grateful for what Bob and his team has done to get this monument put there. You know, it's a lot more permanent, I think, than a tree.
Oh, yeah.
No offense to people who like trees as monuments, but I think that this is going to be very exciting. I found a picture of the monument, and it's up on our website at veteransradio.net. Mike, you mentioned that you're in the Oklahoma. I think we had Mr. Ford on our program in the past, a lot of areas around the country are starting to have Vietnam veteran memorials, and it takes people like Bob here in the local area. It took us a long time to get a memorial built in our local county, but I think people are coming around. It's just taken a while.
So Bob's going to be inducted into Oklahoma Military Hall of Fame for his service and the things he did for the community.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote it up. It's 3 pages of what he's done for the community. 3 pages. It's just astonishing, because it's an image that all need to see. We're at a time in our lives where we need to give back, and he's really shown us how to do it.
Well, I think a lot of us are doing that, and that's important. I think many of us are being mentors to this generation of veterans. The ones in our local area, they really admire the Vietnam veterans. They appreciate that we are there for them. You know, our motto is that never again will another, you know, one generation of veterans not take care of their other ones, which is a bad paraphrase there, but you all understand what I mean. So we've got about 3 minutes left, so I'm going to give each of you about a minute to go. So, Hugh, is there anything you'd like to say?
Well, very quickly, nobody is going to know our story if we don't tell it. And Mike Sloniker, as the historian for the VHPA, has led the pack in memorializing our story. Bob Hesselbein is a past president and the Memorial Committee director. All those things come together to keep our story relevant and pure. And both those guys deserve a tremendous vote of gratitude from all of us. So it's been my pleasure. I will see you, Bob, at the memorial. I'm going to be there with Skip Butler, one of Mike's good friends, and we will do the town up with you.
All right. So, Bob, your turn.
I'd like to end this by just reading something that captured my spirit and my heart. Neil Sheehan, who is an aging writer, he's a war correspondent. He wrote the book A Bright Shining Lie. This is what he expressed, and I'd like to read it. Mm-hmm. The aviation units were the sole combat element that did not come apart under the stress of the war in Vietnam. Whether it was the oneness of man and the acrobatic flying machine, whether it was the equally shared risk of officer, pilot, and enlisted crew member, whatever the reason, the men of the helicopters kept their discipline and their spirit. And I think no finer words can describe what the helicopter pilots and crew members did during the Vietnam War.
Thank you very much. All right, Mike?
I'd like to highlight Gary Roush, who I worked with from 88 to 90, on getting all the data on the guys that were killed, all services.
Absolutely.
I was in the building at the Pentagon. I would go down there and talk to the Defense Intelligence Agency's POW MIA office. They had data, but they needed our data. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Skip Butler. We helped him find remains during that time frame. But Gary is a wizard with information technology. So that's what all that is. So anybody listening in the audience, they can go to the website and you can find everything you need to know about who it was, what aircraft, et cetera. And that's what happens to me frequently here, where the families want to know something, and I just refer them to that website.
Right,
Gary put that together.
That's the VHPA.org. You can find out all the aircraft, when they went down, how they went down. That's where you can, if you have one in your center of your town, you get the tail number on it, it's in that, on that website. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on our program today. I want to make sure we all keep in touch so I can have you back and tell more of these stories, because if we don't tell our stories, somebody else is going to do it and they're going to mess it up. So we got to go.